Dine in Brooklyn is a 10-day event featuring restaurants in the greatest borough on planet Earth. Learn more at dineinbk.com and discover the best of Brooklyn's restaurants Monday, March 20th through Thursday, March 30th.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome, everyone, to The Line. We're here broadcasting live from Heritage Radio Network Studios in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and I'm excited to welcome my guest today. Spike Jurdy is a chef, restaurateur, and local food advocate based in Baltimore. He runs Woodbury Kitchen, Artifact Coffee, Bird in Hand, Parts in Labor, Grand Crew, and they have a canning operation called Woodbury Pantry. He's a busy guy. They have a new hotel project opening soon that we'll talk about. In 2015, Spike became the first and only Baltimore chef to bring home the James Beard Foundation Award for Best Chef Mid-Atlantic. So we have a wonderful amount of diverse food operations to cover today. I want to dive right in and start talking about your working relationship with your brother, because that's of interest to me because my business partner is my brother. So I want to jump all the way back to Spike and Charlie's. So you opened it in 1991, and then you went on to open a few other restaurants together. I'm curious, are any of those spots still around? How was it working with your brother? And how did you originally end up teaming up with your brother way back in the day?
Wow. First answer, no. Those all of those establishments are now under different owners and operators. Mm-hmm. But it was a great time for us. And we decided, the thought process behind it is now lost. If there was one, it's lost to the sands of time, because we just decided to open a restaurant. I mean, there was, I guess, some morning we used to play restaurant. You know, we used to play restaurant when we were kids. And so we opened a restaurant when, I don't know, the time seemed right.
So when you say play restaurant, what does that even consist of?
It was actually the best business model I'd ever had, because our parents would buy the ingredients, and then we would do the restaurant, and then they would pay us to eat there. And so we had the best food costs of my life in those early days.
Yeah, it's great just to have all the burden of COGS go on to the purchaser.
Yes.
There you go.
I got to bring that back, because that really, you can get people to do
that. Yeah, just quadruple all your prices.
Yes.
It's pretty much the same model.
Yeah.
So you and your brother opened up Spike and Charlie's, and was that in the Baltimore area?
That was right downtown Baltimore. We were across the street from the Symphony Hall. So it was a magical time where we both learned the restaurant business.
And so how did you – you were born in Iowa, and you moved to Baltimore when you were a young kid, when you were 6 years old. Do you have any young childhood memories of Iowa? And what are your initial memories like of moving to Baltimore? I imagine it's a pretty jarring move for you and the family.
It was my dad moved us for work, and he was at Procter & Gamble and moved to work in the factory that still is there, but is now Under Armour's world headquarters. So that's kind of cool. Has an amazing new life in that part of the city. It was, you know, I was a kid. Most of my memories of Iowa were of snow. And I don't have many memories of snow in Baltimore, but it wasn't, you know, it just felt like it's what you did. We moved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we didn't, I'm not from a farm. I mean, there's that obvious kind of farm connection, and where I ended up was very much connected to farms again, but it wasn't, I don't think it had an Iowa kind of angle.
So you went sort of like from suburb to suburb to,
yeah,
a certain extent.
Very much.
And so when you ended up in Baltimore, I'm curious about what was food like growing up? Did you have I know you said you played restaurant, but I mean, like, did your family have a close connection to food based on, you know, your family's roots and where they came from or anything like that?
No, I'm definitely not. That's not my story. And I said that once, and I'm always kind of a little slightly hesitant to say, like, I did not learn to cook, you know, at the, you know, at my grandma's knee. Mm-hmm. We enjoyed food as a family, but, you know, my dad had his specialty, which was, you know, Sunday soup. My mom had a couple of things that she did, but I wouldn't characterize us as a food family. It's something I don't know where the gene came from, but
yeah, it's interesting. You know, I get people on the show and they follow obviously different trajectories, but there seems to be like the grandmother anecdote, and then yeah. There seems to be like, I don't know, I fell into it kind of out of nowhere. So I know that you went to Middlebury College, and I am really interested because you studied philosophy and Chinese. So that to me seems like a very relaxed, structured, you know, there's some Buddhism or ancient Chinese thought process that goes into those studies. And obviously philosophy is a deep intellectual pursuit. Are those the type of things that have helped define your career choices and also your leadership style? Because I picture you being a very patient, relaxed person who went to a liberal arts school in Vermont and chilled out pretty hard studying philosophy.
Yeah, I don't know. No, I'm trying to do my old Vermont, my Vermont voice. But no, it was the place. Well, the philosophy in Chinese, I think, that's what I wanted to read in school, and I did. Chinese at Middlebury is not very chill. It's pretty intense, and that's kind of what I was looking for. But at the same time, that's where I really started. The thing that happened for me in Middlebury, that's where I started to think about food in a different way. And I think it was only later that I was able to kind of reconnect what I had studied, just thinking about things the way you do when you're reading philosophy and applying that to what I was doing. That came later. What I did start doing in Vermont was I worked at a bakery at night. You know, in between Chinese philosophy and whatever else was going on, I would show up at this little cool little bakery and start baking at midnight, and then bribe my teachers with fresh bread, you know, when I rolled up a little late the next morning. And that was where I think those seeds got planted. The other thing that happened is after I graduated, I hung around Vermont for the summer and I worked on a dairy farm. And that was as transformative as anything that happened to me. I hate to say it, you know, for the 4 years that I was in school. And that's, I think if anything kind of pointed me down a path, it was those 3 months on Joseph Severy's dairy farm in Cornwall, Vermont that did it.
But why is that? Why was it such a powerful experience for you? Was it the interaction with the product? Was it the hard physical labor? What really brought you around when you were working there?
It was a sense for me. It was this. It was something I could articulate for the first time in my life that I was part of the landscape. I connected to the land there. You know, I had this sense as I was working out in the field, and you know, one day I was just out there. I was collecting bales of hay that had fallen off of a cart, and this big camper came by, tourists, right in Vermont. And they slowed down, and I thought, like, I'm part of this landscape. And that was just like, that was something I never forgot. And, you know, when you think about the way that we think about our food, our sourcing, our connection to growers and our food system, our agricultural economy, that's the thing that kind of carries through.
Some tourist immortalized you as an actual farmer.
There's a farm kid out there.
And you're like, I've only been working here 6 days.
Exactly.
But they thought they had seen a true, authentic thing.
I think I look the part, for sure.
What's a dairy farm like in Vermont? So this is in, the late 80s, early 80s about, or when you're?
Mid-80s.
Mid-80s?
Yeah.
So what's it look like? I imagine that the dairy industrial complex in our country has obviously changed dramatically. So was it a large dairy processing farm? Were you one of five employees?
I was the only one.
Employees?
In fact, okay. I was a summer employee. He had sold some heifers and got enough money to hire me to do some chores and work over the summer. And when the summer ended, I left and he was back on his own. And we milked about 40 cows, which means there was about 60 cows on the farm. A lot of my work was around hay. We were haying and baling hay and putting hay up in the loft and took care of the cows in the morning and the afternoon.
Did he sell it at farmers markets?
He sold it to co-op.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, even then he was thinking about organic. Even then he was, you know, trying to diversify a little bit. He was thinking about getting into maple syrup. And even then, some of the farmers around him and the farms that had been traditionally been dairy farms there in Addison County were getting out of it because it was a commodity thing and they were at the mercy of the commodity market. And a lot of them were getting into were planting Christmas trees.
It's a incredibly difficult business to be in back then, even more so now, to be a small provider of anything. But dairy is extremely difficult if you don't have 10,000 cows,
right,
and industrial milking machine and all the things that come along with being able to store and temp milk properly.
Absolutely. And, you know, I didn't know what I was really seeing at that time, but everything I've learned since then, you know, confirmed how hard it was to do what he was doing. And yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, trying to be a small scale farmer in a commodity world is a tough road to go.
So before we jump fully ahead to your embrace of this, obviously in your own restaurant, so you are spending time in Vermont. My assumption is that always people in Vermont have cared a lot about the land and that they make specific decisions that are not necessarily even informed by economics, but also just like being present with their neighbors and their connection to kind of the land. So you got to see that firsthand working on the dairy farm and then you're baking. What's the next move for you? Do you stay in Vermont or where did you head after that?
I think, you know, with the philosophy degree in hand,
you were wildly employable with exactly. Your philosophy degree and your work experience on a dairy farm.
Yeah, there was pretty much a one-way ticket into the restaurant industry. It wasn't clear the way forward. And so I came back to Baltimore and I was literally walking down the street unemployed and walked past a pastry shop that had just opened, a French pastry shop in Baltimore, which was kind of a, you know, this is again, late 80s at this point. And just stopped in and first I made the mistake of asking if they had any day old, you know, I was still in student mode and they looked at me like, get out of here. And then I was like, well, are you hiring? You know, this is like the worst 1-2 punch ever. So
yeah,
they said, bring back a resume. This is a place called Patisserie Poupon that is still there. And that was my first real, that was where it started for me with cooking and being in a professional kitchen. And
what did they have you doing when you first got hired?
Well, it was, I came back, I actually brought a resume back and they said, well, that's what we do to keep people from, you know, about, and they said, all right, you know, come back at 4 a.m. tomorrow. And the look on my face, they just both started, it was a husband and wife and they're still near and dear to me. And they started laughing. They said, oh, vacation's over. And I came back the next day at 4 and, you know, started doing, making doughs. Just, you know, it was a small French pastry shop and I was the first hire. And we did everything.
We've had bakers on the program before, and a lot of them discuss how they enjoy it's a solitary pursuit. A lot of the time you're in a room by yourself late at night, everyone else is sleeping. Did you enjoy that? Did you find it freeing or lonely or something else?
I just loved being in that kitchen. I loved working with Joseph, who was the chef, the pastry chef. I didn't find it. I did do shifts on my own, but as often as not, we were working together and I was learning, you know, every single second that I was in that kitchen, I was learning as anybody that's in a kitchen for the first time.
How good do you think it is for young people who are getting into cooking to, spend time baking? There's a lot of precision there, right? You're following either large scale recipes or at least where you're often weighing things out. It's not as free as perhaps other cooking experiences. Do you think that contributed anything to then going on and opening up your own place?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I had this funny sense that I was going to be in restaurants. I mean, restaurants are what I wanted to do. The baking part was something I loved doing, an aspect of that. And what I loved about it and that experience and what I got from it was a sense of craft, certain techniques that are kind of old school, but you know, using a piping bag, being able to ice a cake, things that still, you know, occasionally come in handy. And I think that's informed. I like cooking that has a little bit of structure to it. I don't like a pile of this on the plate with a little protein on top. And that's kind of like, which, you know, that's a million ways to think. But I like a tortilla on the plate. I like, you know, I like to use things that are baked. I love great baking. I think the texture that you get from baking is like, that's like, sometimes good baking to me is like about texture and balance. And if you can bring that to your cooking, you're doing something right.
I always am disheartened to go to a wonderful restaurant and find that the bread is an afterthought.
Ugh.
It's for me, it's, I think it's like the biggest mistake that anyone can make. They toss some free bread your way and it starts off the meal on a really weird note. And then if you order anything involving bread, it used to be secondary. Now I think restaurants are really focusing on that, and they're focusing more on where they obtain their
yep.
wheat from
yes.
and their, you know, their milling on site and things
yep.
of that nature.
Yep.
That is something that you're very interested in and that you have been at the forefront of in Baltimore. Can you tell a little bit about how you have found so many wonderful purveyors and how you've organized that around your operation and integrated them into the sort of the Woodbury family of restaurants?
It really started, it was back with my brother through the, you know, what I lovingly refer to as the Spike and Charlie's era, was at least it was for us. Uh-huh. I don't know if anybody else looked. Anyway, so that was those were the years that I was starting to connect with growers in our area. I was starting to connect the dots, you know, again, back to my I don't want to say training, but, you know, going to school for philosophy, I started to think about things and started to understand it, and I think in a little different way. And that built up to opening Woodbury in 2007. So I already knew a lot of the farmers that I wanted to work with. I already was working with them. And you know, Woodbury kind of came into being with this idea, we're going to work with these growers. We're not going to have a, quote, concept that we have to, you know, we have to fulfill. We're going to make this about this kind of transactional relationship, this economic relationship with these farmers. And then we had to figure out how to do it.
So in terms of the actual sourcing, I mean, I think the obvious ingredients that people assume you pull from the Chesapeake Bay area is going to be seafood. But beyond the seafood connection, can you talk about a couple of your favorite products that you integrate into Woodbury or one of your other locations that's sort of like an indigenous product from the area that doesn't travel very far that you've just found like a brilliant representation of it in very close to where you are?
I think the thing that I end up talking about, I think that a product that kind of illustrates that really well is the fish pepper. Fish pepper is a spicy little chili that had definitely played a role in the culinary, in the foodways of the Chesapeake in the 1800s. Michael Twitty and William Boyce Weaver have both written about it. And so I kind of came across it in their writing and then started to ask, found out that there were seed available, mostly due to William Boyce Weaver, and started to ask farmers if they would grow it. And one day a guy came up to me and said, "You looking for fish pepper?" It was like that kind of, you know.
I've got fish pepper.
Yeah. I got some fish
pepper. I got a lot of fish peppers that I need to move. You
right.
want to use them?
And we literally jumped in the car, and this was a guy that was growing, had an urban farm, and that was the first time I saw and tasted fish pepper. And the rest kind of grew from there. But that's a good example. That was something that I came across that I think, you know, really had roots in our region. And now we've taken it. We make a hot sauce from it. We make, you know, we make our own kind of chili powder with it. We pickle it. And it really adds a lot of heat and flavor.
So you did some deep studying of the actual region, looking back and seeing what things were in that area and that perhaps had fallen by the wayside and had fallen out of popularity. I'm also interested in the actual physical space that you developed for Woodbury Kitchen. So can you explain to the listeners that have never been there? So it's in Clipper Mill, and the building's beautiful. I've been there. I've eaten there. And how did you even find the space? And how did you develop it into a restaurant?
So it was friends of mine were kind of – Clipper Mill is this amazing – you're exactly right. It's this incredible old mill, complex, really, with various buildings, some of which – were and are occupied by craftspeople and workshops and ateliers, and some of which are apartments. And there was one kind of space left in the middle of it, and they had thought it could be a cafe. Some of my friends were already, my best friend had a workshop there, and so it was appealing just to say, well, I'm going to take the restaurant next door. And again, that much thought really went into it. I love the location. I got a lot of support from the guy that was developing it to build it out, which I needed at the time, and we were off to the races.
So this becomes the second time that you've gone through the process of starting a, for lack of a better term, we'll call it a restaurant group. It was your, it became your first, second project. How much did you feel confident in 2007 when you opened Woodbury, since you had gone through the process with your brother of opening up restaurants before? Did it feel brand new and terrifying, or did you feel like this was a second coming and you were so ready to do it?
I was ready, but it was, there was a, I mean, the other aspect of Clipper is that it's kind of, it's not easy to find. It's kind of down of, you kind of have to get lost before you find it.
It's a destination restaurant.
If that could be, yeah, I don't know if we have those in Baltimore, but, so there was a little bit of, I don't know if terrified, but, there was some anxiety to get that thing going and then to not really know how to do what we wanted to do and to not really know if anybody was going to show up.
How far away is it from like Baltimore proper, say a drive?
Like if you're in the harbor, which is kind of for, you know, in Baltimore, a lot of people orient themselves from the inner harbor. It's about 5 miles north. Baltimore is grew from that, the harbor and that central kind of area up. In our case, up industrially, it grew up this little river valley, which is very cool, which is where we are, which is why the mills are there. We're kind of straight north up that little valley.
And so when you opened up Woodbury, you partnered with your wife.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about her background and what do both of you at that time, not specifically today, what were your responsibilities? Were you actually on the line cooking for service? And what was her role in Woodbury?
You know, I was in the kitchen and she basically did everything else. When the restaurant opened, and I wouldn't recommend anyone to try this at home, but I worked the front of the oven, which was kind of my spot. We have this incredible wood burning oven, built in place masonry oven, and she expedited. And that's where it started. That's how we started. And that's, those were amazing. You know, especially as it got busier and we started to get our feet underneath us, it was an amazing time.
What was her previous experience like expediting? Because Woodbury's pretty big, right?
Yeah, we weren't doing, you know, some of the numbers we do now, mm-hmm. but we got there. But it's about 100 inside. We're around 110 seats. We could add 30 when it's nice out, and but we kind of grew into. Doing more covers. So back then it felt stressful, and you know, when I do 120 off the front of the oven, I'd end up like curled up in a ball at the end of the night. But sorry, I lost my, what was your,
oh yeah, I was just about you and your wife and launching Woodbury.
Yeah, so she, you know, she was there and we did it every night, just figured it out.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more with Spike, owner of Woodbury Kitchen in Baltimore.
Dine in Brooklyn is a 10-day event featuring restaurants in the greatest borough on planet Earth. Taking place Monday, March 20th through Thursday, March 30th, Dine in Brooklyn is celebrating the five-star flavors that make Brooklyn a must-taste destination. From the Asian-inspired flavors at Nightingale 9 in Carroll Gardens to classic barbecue at Mabel's Smokehouse in Williamsburg, the Brooklyn restaurant scene has something for everyone. Unwind with a bottle of vino at Soigner Restaurant and Wine Bar in Park Slope, dream of summer at Clemente's Crab House in Sheepshead Bay, or be transported to a Gothic Irish monastery while drinking a Guinness in hand at the Wicked Monk in Bay Ridge. Restaurants are offering their choice of $28 prefix three-course dinners, $15 two-course lunches, or $12 weekend brunch. Visit dineinbk.com to view all of the participating restaurants and their menus. Make your reservations now to discover the diversity of flavors that Brooklyn has to offer. Dine in Brooklyn is taking place Monday, March 20th through Thursday, March 30th. Learn more at dineinbk.com.
Welcome back to The Line. I'm here with Spike Jurdy. He's the chef, restaurateur, owner of Woodbury Kitchen, Artifact Coffee, Bird in Hand, Parts and Labor, Grand Cru, and Woodbury Pantry, located in the Baltimore area. We were talking about his early career partnering with his brother, and in 2007, with his wife, he opened Woodbury Kitchen, a wonderful restaurant in Clipper Mill, and since then, you've been on a tear, so... It seems like every year you're opening up a spot now. And so let's just quickly rattle them off and then we'll go back and talk about them. In 2012, you opened up Artifact Coffee. 2014, you opened Parts and Labor, which is a whole animal butcher shop and also a restaurant. In 2016, you worked on a bookshop cafe, which you co-own with a couple other partners. And then you've got a hotel project in the works. And then you've got the canning operation. Okay, that's insane. Let's now go backwards and try to unpack a little bit of this. So let's start in 2012. You were like, all right, the restaurant is going well. I want to move on to another project. I'm curious, are you super obsessed with coffee? I find that people that get in the coffee game, it's so competitive and people discuss coffee now in the way that they discuss a wonderful glass of wine, and prices are actually creeping up to that level as well. So tell me a little bit about your passion for coffee and what Artifact Coffee does maybe that other places in Baltimore weren't doing, or why you decided to get involved in the coffee world.
It was a macchiato. You know, we'd always had coffee in the restaurants, my brother and I, and I think we tried. What can you say? It was a macchiato in San Francisco. It was a little blue bottle pop-up at the farmer's market. And I just had this moment. Like a lot of us who have, you know, have had moments like that with coffee. I feel a little funny talking about it even. But so we had this moment and came back. And we actually got excited about coffee and opened an Artifact. We called it Artifact. And it was in a side room of where Woodbury is. And as we built out the restaurant, we operated this little coffee shop just to kind of tide us over until Woodbury got going. And that was Artifact in 2006, 2007. And we were among the first, I think, to really kind of try to do what other people were doing with coffee, but do it in Baltimore. You know, the coffee I had in San Francisco, stuff that was happening in New York. That's where it started. And then had this, and then rolled kind of Artifact and that approach to coffee into the restaurant, which is kind of a new thing, not only for Baltimore, but you know, we were talking about how bread, you know, sometimes can take down a really nice dining experience, and coffee was doing the same thing for me. You know, a lot of places that were paying attention to other things were like just coffee was kind of a throwaway, and so we were among the first, I think, to have a barista making coffee in the restaurant, and then. You're right. You know, it took 5 years really for us to kind of get our feet under us. And then we opened Artifact again, just up the road.
Do you roast beans there? What are you doing at Artifact now? And do you have any plans to do another one?
So the idea with Artifact was to take, and one of the things I love about it is we take everything that we do at Woodbury, the entire approach around sourcing, and we translated that to, I think, what is an understandable, accessible coffee shop experience. So the menu is essentially soup, salad, sandwich. But all of those things are, you know, are locally sourced. A lot of those things are of our own kind of manufacture, breads, meats, pastries. And it was just, for me, it was just, A, I love coffee shops. And B, I wanted to do something with the food that we were working with at Woodbury that was not Woodbury. And that was, and you know, hopefully bring it to a different price point, a different kind of experience, and that's what we did. And Artifact is, you know, a kitchen about the size of the studio, and we do everything that we do at Woodbury there.
Just so you all know, listening, this is a very small studio. So it seems like there is a vertical integration that's taking place, which is you are finding all these things that you want to do, and they're interacting with all the other businesses. So then you move on to open up Parts and Labor, which is a whole animal butcher shop. Is there a roadmap? Were you thinking to yourself, all right, we've got a restaurant, it's successful and it's great, now let's focus on coffee. All right, now let's tackle a butcher shop. Like, were these things intentionally opened in a series of years, or did it just there was a necessity and you thought, let's go for it? How much planning actually goes into these places several years in advance?
I think starting with Parts and Labor is where we had identified what needed to happen for us to grow and to continue to support our growers and to continue to kind of scale. You know, like you said earlier, we're kind of living in this commodity world, and we were trying to make our way in that world. And with Parts and Labor, that's where we started to take steps to do that. So what Parts and Labor for me really represented was our ability to work with meat in the way that we were doing it at Woodbury, whole animal butchery, a lot of production, trying to drive value and drive value back to small-scale producers. And it was going to become a bottleneck for us if we didn't find a way to do more of it. So, you know, the point being that, you know, if I wanted to do another artifact, there was just only so much we could do, so much roast beef and sausage that we could make at Woodbury to supply other places. So Parts and Labor was that place. And, you know, it's a very cool little butcher shop. It's a cool little restaurant, but at its heart, and what it mainly is a production butchery.
So from then, you go on to open up Bird in Hand. And so I have to be honest, your opening rate is pretty astonishing. It's like once you got going, you really got going here. So, you know, I know you're going to say you've got incredible partners and that you've got a wonderful staff, but like, let's just really dig beneath that a little bit. How do you sustain this growth? Do you have business mentors that you and your wife can reach out to you? Do you have investors that help navigate this terrain? Because you have 250 employees now, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not a wonderful little husband-wife restaurant anymore. You're a fairly large company that is on the move. So how do you maintain your leadership, and also how do you maintain the organization of your entire sprawling operation?
I think what's been essential to our growth is we've been able to attract people who get what it is that's happening at Woodbury and feel that it's important, our relationship to our food and how it works and how this company does it. And they're the ones that are kind of powering us to this next level. And it's growth. It's not like open a location. You know, what underlies a lot of the places that have opened recently is the fact that we're doing a lot of this preservation and canning. We're doing our own juices now so that we can support, so that everything we do going down the road, where we are now and where we get to, is going to be supportive of local ag. I mean, it all comes back to that. Ineluctably for us, it comes back to local ag, the landscape. And that will never change. And luckily, I have amazing people around me. You're right. I'm going to mention these partners who are, you know, helping push us forward, who get it and are about it. And, you know, it's every single person that cooks at Woodbury, but it's Hannah Reagan, it's Corey Paloka, it's Opie Crooks. It's these amazing people that work in all aspects of our business that are making it possible.
How much crossover is there between businesses? Is there like a manager meeting where everyone from like the top person at each spot, like either a chef or a front of house person, gets together and exchange ideas or anything? Are they siloed a little bit and you're the go-between? How much interaction is there between a place like the canning operation and say Parts and Labor?
Well, that's a great question. They are siloed as far as them being restaurants, but there is this underlying network that we've created that's baking, that's processing and preserving, and that's meat. And those things are like, that's a network. And those things inform and supply each other. So we've got this cool little network that we've got this little truck that kind of goes between canning shed where we do our preserving, that goes to Parts and Labor, and that goes to Woodbury where we still bake. And that is kind of the connection, and that's all based on, you know, the local ingredients that we use. We can't find I be buying bread if there was somebody in Baltimore that was baking, you know, with 100% locally grown and milled grains. But it's not happening, so we're baking bread.
I love that. When you can't find it, you got it pushes you to do it yourself. So the canning operation, that sounds pretty cool. Are you doing anything with that that's like a wholesale or like business-to-business distribution? Do you have little, like, are there any shops or cafes that sell your canned goods? Or is it all used in-house at the restaurants?
So it all started to supply ourselves. And lately we've gotten into doing more retail sizes because we wanted to be able to, you know, the jam that we use at Woodbury that we put up in the summertime, we wanted to be able to sell that retail. So we now do that. Our whole economic model is a little different. And so for restaurant operators, our products are a little pricey, we found. We intercompany them. So we move them around and we actually buy them. You know, Woodbury will buy it from, will buy jam from Canning Shed. Our first foray into getting a product out there that other people want to work with, both retail and wholesale, is we co-pack some tomatoes, some Maryland grown tomatoes for the first time last summer. And that's in number 10 cans and 28 ounce cans for supermarkets. And that is finding some traction in the...
How is that branded, though? Is that branded as Woodbury Kitchen tomatoes?
Those are Spike's tomatoes.
Okay, Spike's tomatoes.
And, you know, my brother, too...
Another project, sure.
Yeah, and my brother, to his everlasting credit, is one of our customers, so I'm very proud to be selling tomatoes to my brother.
In what capacity?
He's buying them and using them in his spots.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. So he's got his own spots
as well. Yeah.
Okay. And so the overall kind of continuation of all these projects is that I assume that somewhere you're thinking about not only what the next project is going to be, but where internal growth can come from. What is something sort of removed from the hotel project? What is something that you see in the next, say, 2 to 5 years for you that you're really excited about potentially growing larger?
The baking for us, you know, the Mid-Atlantic is... I think of the Mid-Atlantic was kind of as the breadbasket for, you know, a very young country. Going back, you know, after we had independence and this country was, you know, kind of finding its way. And the Mid-Atlantic was where a lot of the grain was produced. Baltimore as a port, you know, came into its own, not because of tobacco, which wasn't really shipped from the port of Baltimore, but because of wheat. And, you know, wheat was what replaced tobacco as kind of a cash crop in our region in the early 1800s. And Baltimore as a port kind of grew up as a shipping point for wheat and flour. So we had a lot of mills and even baked goods. I kind of want to restore that part of our food economy, which is based on growing and milling small grains, which we don't see very much of. And we're going to bake with that, and that's going to be huge for us.
I'm curious about the dynamics that you have with all the workers at your restaurant. You were well ahead of the curve in embracing locality and sourcing. And now one of the big things that restaurants are dealing with is the business side of it from the aspects of raise the wage. And there's been a lot of discussion about tipping. And now with the current administration, we're talking about sanctuary restaurants and something that kitchens never discussed 20 years ago, which was a safe place physically and mentally for your employees. So as one of the leaders of your entire operation, I'm curious, how are you, your wife, and the other folks at the top addressing some of these employee-related issues that are really sort of like hot button topics right now?
We're concerned. We're concerned. We're worried. You know, Baltimore... It's funny. I can go back. I remember a time when there weren't immigrants working in kitchens in Baltimore. When I started, there wasn't an immigrant presence in kitchens in Baltimore, and now they're an integral part of our world. And I'm concerned about what's going to happen. And we're talking to lawyers, we're talking to advocates, and trying to understand, you know, what could happen and what we need to do to be ready. You know, I would say I thought when we had a day without immigrants a couple of weeks ago, and I thought that was a brilliant day, and you know, what I heard from people in my industry was a little confusing, because a lot of them said, we're closing in solidarity with our, you know, with our, and I thought that's kind of missing the point and kind of misrepresenting what's happening here, because, you know, what we should have said, and what I thought should have been the message, is we're closing because we can't operate without these folks. And I thought it kind of took the powerful message that was being asserted there was watered down by the people that were trying to be, you know, kind of supportive. And I think that's, you know, when we understand, if you know anything about food, you know, how it's grown, how it's processed, how it gets to your table, sometimes like literally to your table, you know, that it takes a lot of hands, a lot of people. And a lot of those in our case and in many others are recent, or, you know, we're multi-generational now in our restaurants with folks that have worked with us for years. And now their sons and daughters are working with us. It's amazing. And I wouldn't have it any other way.
Spike, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, if you're in the Baltimore area, there's multiple places that you can check out what they're doing. They are doing things right and embracing the local, the land and the people and the purveyors and the providers. Check out Woodbury Kitchen and all their other restaurants. Spike, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Join us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. for The Line here on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.